On this episode of Comedy Rewind, is Dumb and Dumber the perfect 90s comedy? Does Jeff Daniels' performance hold up even better than Jim Carrey's? Do they even make movies like this one anymore? All of this and more on Comedy Rewind.
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 Push rewind. I thought this was a comedy show.
What's going on, guys? Welcome to Comedy Rewind. We are talking Dumb and Dumber, and I'm here, Jono Peck, joined by two guys who can triple stamp a double stamp. It's Beard and Beardier, Benny McJanet and Brendan White. How you fellas doing?
Pretty good.
Doing great, thank you.
Who's Beardier at the moment? We both go through different stages of Beardier each year.
I think you might have it at the moment, Benny.
Maybe.
A bit more length.
Challenge accepted.
But it's got a bit of like the grey in there that adds a bit of depth and texture, so I don't know.
Oh yeah, he's had that salt and pepper guy for a long time.
It's all good. So we're here to talk about what I think is a smart movie about dumb people. And I know that it has a very special place in my heart. And I want to know, what was your background with Dumb and Dumber as, a movie that we all probably grew up with? It's 25 years old now.
It is one of the touchstones of my childhood. Like, it is one of my top 10 favorite movies of all time to this day. Yep. And like, obviously, if I didn't watch it at such a young age, it probably wouldn't have had the impact that it did on me. But just at that time, it was 94. I was 8 years old. Dumb jokes, farts, poos, dead animals, all that kind of stuff. Like, it was just the perfect gateway movie for me into that sort of teen, early adulthood comedic styling and into that Farrelly Brothers universe. And I love it. I love everything about this movie, and I can still watch it now and still laugh my ass off, even though I know exactly what's going to happen at every single scene and every line. And it's just the best. It's one of the best comedies in my universe, at least, of all time.
Did you watch it at the cinema? Like, do you have it? Remember the first time you saw it?
My mum took me to the cinema to watch this, so it's got a nice memory there. I had the bucket of popcorn at the Kuma. I think it was called the Kuma Twin Cinemas, but it was only one cinema because the other one sort of broke. So I remember sitting these hard-ass, stiff wooden chairs. Cinema screen's probably not much bigger than my television screen these days. With the big old Coke and the big old popcorn and just laughing my head off right from the opening scenes, limo driving and cracking them bad Aussie accents all the way to the end credits. And it was just a hell of a ride.
How about you, Benny?
I'm pretty similar vein. Like, it was the Tambourine cinemas for me. And we not only had the wooden chairs, we also had they had deck chairs, and a lot of people would bring their own pillows and stuff to the cinemas and things like that. So I remember seeing this in the cinemas as well. It's actually the same place I saw The Mask, because I was a big Jim Carrey fan as a young kid. After Ace Ventura, The Mask, and then this one. So I did see The Mask and this at the cinemas, and that's the sort of memory it instills in me, is like just watching it back as well, like, because it has been a really long time since I've seen it, and going, oh shit, I forgot this was in this movie. Oh, this was from this movie too? Oh, wow. There's a lot of these memories just come flooding back, and it was such a trip just to rewatch it. Huge part of my childhood, and like I said, I was a big Jim Carrey fan as a young kid, and I think this was 11. I was 11 when this came out, so I just remember this and all the other Jim Carrey films, and that's what stands out to me, is the Jim Carrey side of the film, not so much the Jeff Daniels.
They just kind of lump together.
Yeah, they all do clump together a bit, but then rewatching it now as an adult and watching a little bit more of the Jeff Daniels side of the story and paying a little bit more attention as an adult. Yeah, just, it was really, actually, really a clever, clever movie about really dumb people. And a lot of the jokes are really dumb jokes, but they're very cleverly done.
It's a weird dynamic of it's easy to write it off as just like a stupid movie, stupid Jim Carrey being over the top. But no, it is actually really clever. And the jokes, I think, there's a lot of great plays on words, and there's a lot of great like malapropisms where people are like saying, like they're saying an expression, but they're screwing it up, you know, like tea and strumpets or whatever it might be. So I'm much similar to Brendan. Like, this is a movie that's very close to me. I was a bit older when I saw it. I don't think it was until maybe I was like maybe 10 or 11 years old, because I wasn't probably allowed to go see it. But I remember my dad laughing his head off watching a movie in the living room when I was in bed and finding out that it was Dumb and Dumber. And like my grandpa, you know, just this is so stupid, but laughing nonstop as well.
Old
and
grandpa pick.
Like rewatching it the other night, I laughed out loud so much. And it just took me back to like hearing my dad from the other room, you know. It's just a movie that I have watched every few years, if not like when I was younger all the time. So like Brendan, it's something that's always kind of just been there. I've always appreciated it. And I've kind of like bonded with people who appreciated it as well. And that will continue throughout this podcast, I think. So it's, as you said, Benny, it was a really amazing run for Jim Carrey. This was like kind of his first year of being a Hollywood star. Pet Detective, The Mask, Dumb and Dumber, back to back in 1994. First person to lead three movies to number one in a row, or in 1 year, I should say, which I don't even know if anyone else would have done it since then. It's such a rare thing that they all just released at the same time.
I'd say he probably still owns that record. Like, I can't think of many sort of AAA Hollywood celebs that have done three movies in 1 year, let alone two. These days, so
yeah,
it's besides The Rock, really. Moment. But I can't say he's had three number ones.
That's
in
a good
year.
Call, actually. The Rock, but outside of that,
yeah,
but
it really would take the perfect storm for it to happen, I think. And that's what happened for him. Just reading some background on it, like when they were in negotiations to make this movie, his salary was something like $750,000, and then these other movies came out, and he's like, actually, I'll take $7 million, and that was almost half the budget for the entire movie.
Yeah, and did you hear what like Jeff Daniels got paid $50,000 for this movie? He got $50,000, and Jim Carrey got $7 million. Like, it's insane.
That's insane.
Did you hear the story behind that difference?
How they didn't want to cast him.
Yeah, the studio was like, we don't want him. He's not a comedian. He's obviously known for these dramatic roles. So even though Jim Carrey and the Farrelly brothers are big fans of his, we're going to lowball him. And his agent like begged him not to take it, said like Jim Carrey's going to like run away with it and you're not going to be able to keep up with him or whatever it might be. But he is so good in this film. And I think, you know, like Benny said, Jim Carrey's what stands out when you're a kid. But then as you grow older, and maybe it's because you've seen Jeff Daniels in things like The Newsroom or Looper or whatever else. Like, he was in The Martian. He's playing the head of NASA, one of the smartest people in the world.
Yeah.
And then you see him in this, and it's like, yeah, he really got into that role.
Like, watching it back, I reckon he had a lot of fun playing that role. Yeah. And it was probably just a refreshing change of pace for him as well. Mm. Just the scenes with the frostbite on the frost tongue on the ski lift, and then the diarrhea scene as well later on as well. Like, he just like playing those scenes. I reckon he just had an absolute ball doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so against type for him to do this kind of movie. And there's a story where he was playing golf and Clint Eastwood came up to him and said, "I saw Dumb and Dumber," and he was kind of like, "Oh no, like what's he gonna say?"
Yeah,
and he's like, "That toilet scene was the funniest thing I've ever seen. The exact same thing happened to me on a date, and the toilet broke, and I didn't know what to do." So, it's something that he's known for, despite this like history of dramatic roles, and just the way he dives straight into it. He really holds his own next to Jim Carrey. Like,
oh yeah,
it would be so easy to get lost into that black hole of like charismatic, over the top, chewing the scenery. So the rest of the cast is mostly just kind of supporting what these guys are doing in terms of the humor. There's not really any jokes that come from outside of these guys, but you've got Lauren Holly there as Mary Swanson, and Jim Carrey had a brief marriage with her. Mike Starr played Joe Mentolino, aka the Gas Man. And he's one of those character actors that you've just seen kind of pop up in everything.
He's in everything. Yeah, he's brilliant. He's great in all these little roles that he does.
Yeah, like he's,
yeah, he's just great.
Been on like Chicago Fire and West Wing and The Office, and you've seen him probably on like House and all kinds of soap operas. But yeah, as I mentioned before, $17 million this movie cost to make. Jim Carrey pocketed $7 million of that. It made $247 million. So you can see why after this he could kind of write his own ticket and just do pretty much whatever he wanted as far as comedies go. The last episode we did, I talked about Adam Sandler going on kind of a crazy run, but this Jim Carrey run is even more impressive. Apart from Ace, The Mask, and Dumb and Dumber, he followed it up with Batman Forever, which, you know, it's a Batman movie, so regardless of whether it's good or bad, Then another Ace Ventura movie, The Cable Guy, Liar Liar, The Truman Show, Man on the Moon. All, I think, quite rewatchable movies that we could pretty much cover on this podcast if we wanted to.
You know what was on last night? Like, sorry to interrupt there, but Bruce Almighty was on last night. And we watched that again. And even that just holds up really well. Like, it's nowhere near as old as 94. I think it might be like 2002 or 2003.
Yeah, it's those early 2000s.
But it's bang on. And even like Steve Carell was known as Stephen Carell back then because that was sort of one of his first roles. And
yeah, it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, the comedic timing between him and Jim Carrey in a few of those scenes is impeccable as well.
That's a good kind of segue into what have you done for me lately. So Jim Carrey has kind of gone off the deep end. There's been some really interesting like red carpet interviews and stuff where he just goes into some philosophical diatribe about things that are way beyond my comprehension. But did you guys watch the show Kidding? It's on Stan in Australia. I really enjoyed
it. It's heavy. It is really heavy. Like, I don't know if you know much about the show, but he's sort of a
kids entertainer.
Yeah, a kids entertainer. His family are involved in a car crash and they lose their son. And so him and his wife are separated and he's now in a single bedroom little sweat box still trying to keep it together and act this facade as this happy sunshine rainbows child entertainer. But then behind it, there's this real dramatic layer and you don't really see him do many of these dramatic performances out of, what was that movie?
I mean, he's done quite a few, like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. There's, yeah. Truman Show is a comedy, but it has a lot of dramatic acting chops in there, and
Man on the Moon's
it's a good hybrid one as well. But and Kidding is more along those lines where it's funny, but he's also got this kind of there's a darker edge to it. And he had that phase where he tried to kind of prove himself as a dramatic actor, and I think that, you know, he has definitely got a lot of ability. It's just not really what people want to see from him. I think like Number 14 or whatever that movie's called.
That's the one I was thinking of.
Number 24? I think it's number 23. I actually really enjoyed that movie too. I like that movie a lot.
But yeah, apart from that show, that TV show, it's and I guess the fact that he's doing a TV show is another big departure for him. But Dumb and Dumber 2 came out 5 years ago. I don't want to talk about that really. I will mention it later because it's relevant to this somehow. But Sonic the Hedgehog, we've got to look forward to. Dr. Robotnik.
My God. I'm excited because it looks like we're going to see a bit of sort of tour de form, like nostalgic Jim Carrey with his facial animations and he's just over the top, dialed to 1000 Jim Carrey-ness again. So
yeah,
it's literally the sort of role where he can be that cartoon character again.
And he's played a few actual cartoon characters as well.
Oh, yeah.
Jeff Daniels has probably had a better career as late. You know, I mentioned The Martian, The Newsroom, he's quite good in. He's at the moment, I think, doing a pretty well-received run as Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird. That's like a stage show that's getting a lot of praise. So he's still putting in those hard yards and getting some critical acclaim. The others in this movie, I mentioned the Gas Man being a pretty steady actor, but I haven't seen any of the other cast really pop up in anything substantial, so they're probably not worth jumping into. Does anyone want to hazard a guess as to the number one song when this movie released in late 1994?
Ooh, 94? I'm thinking it's going to be some kind of real shitty rock, like radio rock type of song.
Number one?
It's the end of the grunge era.
I don't think we would have seen any Nirvana or Faith No More at the top of the pops.
No, Kurt Cobain was well and truly dead by that stage.
Can I say like Ace of Base?
You can say whatever you want.
I'm going to say an Ace of Base song, like that All That She Wants Is Another Baby song.
Yeah, okay. Well, the answer is Here Comes the Hot Stepper by Ina Kamoze.
Oh, I've got that on my Spotify playlist.
Which is great because it's a reggae kind of hip hop song, and there's a few of those tracks in this movie as well, so it's fairly appropriate. That's the one. Do you want to guess the Rotten Tomatoes percentage for this one? Looking at how it was received at the time.
It was actually really well praised from what I remember at the time.
I'm going to go with somewhere around 73.
Mm. I was going to say 70.
That's a good guess because it was 67.
Oof.
Ah! So it's kind of just scraping over the line as fresh.
I'll take the price of Price is Right.
Price is Right rules. You take the money. But we'll get into the questions now. So what was the most 90s moment of this film for you guys?
This is a tough one for me because there's just like, I think it's nine. Obviously it was set in the 90s, but it's just a definitive 90s film from front to back. Mm. Like,
mm.
I think the one that comes to mind for me the most is just those vibrant ass blue and orange tuxedos.
Yes.
Yep. That they roll into the sort of the endangered owl species benefit.
Yeah.
For some reason, I just think that's definitive 90s because I remember having a pair of pretty bright, insane orange shorts, and I think of like Hypercolor and things like that as a 90s kid. So
it's very Nickelodeon-ish or something like that, so, isn't it?
So I'm going to sort of double down on the tuxes with that just insane color palette.
I'm going to say probably the most 90s thing about it is the soundtrack.
Yeah.
Because the soundtrack in it is the songs that really are from that time period. Mm. And a lot of them were what we'd consider indie bands now, realistically, coming up and coming indie bands. It kind of has that same sort of vibe watching it back. Yeah. I was like, wow, like listening to the soundtrack, I was like, man, this is a really good soundtrack.
It is.
I remember that Mary Moon song or whatever it was.
That's so good. I use that on the Comedy Rewind trailer because it, like you said, it just feels like the 90s. And
yeah.
There are a couple of songs like Pretty Woman by Roy Orbison and
there's a few songs that aren't really.
The Dream Sequence has like an old 60s song, but for the most part, like all the music when they're driving the car or they're in cafes and that kind of thing, they're all these like rock tunes or pop tunes from the 90s. And I was a big listener of the official soundtrack for this movie over the years, and I still really appreciate all the tunes on there, even though it didn't have Boom Shakalaka. The kind of that opening track, which that is really just so 90s to me.
That's a real rude boy.
Yeah.
Sort of song. And absolutely. Yeah, I love that stuff.
My most 90s moments, I had driving around looking for jobs at the start of the movie. Like that's just something that wouldn't happen now. Like they're like, I can't believe we spent all day looking for jobs and there's nothing. Like you just pull out the phone app and you'd scroll through. The other thing was getting lost as they were driving. That also wouldn't happen with the use of GPSs and Google Maps. And it's good because it reminds me when I first started driving, and you guys are a little bit older than me, so I'm sure you can relate, of having to like pull out the map. For us in Victoria, it was the Melways. I don't know what it was up.
We had the Gregory's.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, G7 and having to like pull over to the side of the road and be like, where the heck am I? Like, that was something that's just not an issue anymore, thank goodness.
It's very true.
It's one of those things, yeah. Try explaining to someone how you used to look at a map and they just look at you with blank eyes. Mm.
Driving halfway across the country, a sixth of the way across the country.
I've done that as well, using a map.
Going the wrong way.
Yeah, felt that way.
Jeez. All right. So, we've mentioned a couple of them already, but what do you think is the most iconic scene in Dumb and Dumber?
I don't know if you can narrow this down just to one. Like, there is just scene after scene in this.
We'll have some contenders, yeah.
Yeah, like as Benny mentioned, the whole snow scene just cracks me up. Like, when she joyfully throws a snowball at him and he just winds just one up.
Nails her.
Just cold clocks her right in the face.
And then does the crash tackle as well.
Yeah. One of my favorite scenes is when they're interviewing when they sell the Petey the Parakeet to Billy. And they're like, I just thought he was really quiet. Like, that gets me every single time.
It's a great callback to, like, a joke from pretty much the start of the movie as well. Like, just a great way to bring it around.
Yeah. But toilet scene as well, like as Benny said, that explosive diarrhea. And then when Mary's like, Harry, you okay? He's like, yeah, I'm just shaving. And she's just like, oh.
And that moment where it's like, I hope you know, the toilet's broken. I hope you haven't used it.
Yeah.
And like that moment of horror. Like, I think we've all experienced that in one form or another.
That guilt ridden.
Whether it's like a toilet that doesn't want to cooperate or whatever it might be. Just like, oh, what am I going to do? How am I going to hide this?
Mm. Yeah. I think there's a couple of other ones that really stand out to me is at the fundraising dinner with the birds and the... Harry's talking to Mary and he's talking about how they bred dogs and he crossbreeds the bulldog with the shih tzu. And he goes, we called it a bullshit. That joke stuck with me throughout my entire teenage years.
Yeah.
And you know what? If I still had the opportunity to use it today, I would. Because it's a fucking fantastic joke.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the way he laughs at it, like, instantly, yeah. and just cracks up. Yeah. It's so perfect.
And even the lead-in joke before that, when he's like, oh, nice to who's that you got?
Yeah. Oh, it's great. Yeah, that's so you mentioned it there, the ballroom scene. Mm. I think if you're talking iconic, like the image that just comes to your head when you think of this movie, it is those guys in the tuxedos.
Fluoro tuxedos, you know, yeah.
Turning up and like sword fighting and then like trying to act all classy. Mm. And
then he's like, time out. And then yeah. he just wails him on the back of the legs.
Yeah. Everything about that is so good. Like spraying the mouth spray in the guy's eye yep. and then like telling Harry to tell Mary that he has a rapist wit. Like it's just like... like that scene, and like, I'm just gonna stay at the bar and put out the vibe. There's so many good lines.
Actually, I love the bit where he's doing the whole standing at the bar thing, and there's that one bit where he's leaning over the bar. He's got like the jacket from the tuxedo up over his ass. He's purposely putting the ass out. I'm like, man, that is a go-to move. If ever I saw one, I love it. Because I was like yeah. watching the movie, and I'm like, this is the movie where he does the thing with the bar. I'm sure this is in this one, and it came up, and I was like, yes. I knew it was from here, but oh, I love that bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another one I want to give mention to is the car scene when they've got Mental in there and yes. they're like, hey, you want to hear the most annoying sound in the world? And it's,
yeah. so, like, I have that on that... here too, because that is so good. And like, that's an ad-libbed line, apparently. You can see like Jeff Daniels laughing as it comes out of his mouth.
yeah, but I think another one that's really good is the cop pulling him over. After he's pissed in all the beer bottles.
But even the lead into that where he's like, pull over, and he's like, no, it's a cardigan, but thanks for noticing.
yeah, that's brilliant. But I think the most iconic movie, and maybe it's because we're Australian, is right at the very start with the fake Australian accent and I like it a lot and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. And especially because we are Australian, it stands out so much to us. Because you can do that I like a lot thing in the Austria and Australia joke. It's an old joke, but everyone in Australia knows it.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that just stands out to us.
That's a good contender, absolutely. Aside from, I think, the tuxedos being like a visual that stands out to me is the dream sequence. And I think it might be like, you know, I mentioned like my early memories of this film. I think the earliest could actually be where I actually saw it with my own eyes was someone on a talk show, whether it was like Jim Carrey on Oprah or something, where they played that clip of him doing the like kung fu scene where he like is acting like an idiot and like one of the Three Stooges or something. And then he rips out that guy's heart. Like that sequence always cracks me up.
Puts it in the doggy bag.
But even like his... like it's his dream. That's like what's going on inside his head and his interpretation of like a date going well with Mary, and he like trying to impress her by farting into a cigarette lighter. It's just a really good insight into how his head ticks.
It's kind of scary too, because old Lloyd Christmas, he's got like murderous tendencies in both his dream sequences. yeah. Like at the end as well, where he guns down Mary's husband. Yeah. You know, like
we'll get to that. We will get to that for sure. Yeah. So. Are there any other iconic scenes?
I don't know about iconic, but iconic visuals is the dog van.
Oh, yes. We have to mention the dog van. Like, as a visual gag, it just works every time.
Yeah. Especially at the start when he's late to get to the dog show and it's just getting air over those huge jumps. Yeah. Like, this thing's getting like 2 feet off the ground and he's feeding the actual dogs giant foot-long hot dogs and everything else. And then even Harry's, how he's in the dog costume as well.
I think my favorite visual with the van is when he's filling it with petrol and it starts to just like spill everywhere and the leg is like lifted up like a dog would cock its leg to take a slash. Like that gets me.
Yeah. And then there was like the whole like, oh, nice skis. And he's like, they're yours. She's like, yeah.
Both
like,
of them.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah. It's just amazing that they both kind of seem to have a chance with that chick. I guess she's undercover, like following them, you figure out by the end of it, the FBI agent. But yeah, it's great. So what holds up the best? Because like for me, I tend to agree with you, Brenda, like this movie just holds up all around. Like it's hard to pinpoint something, but I think it's still funny. Like it's still everything it set out to do back then still works for me now.
I think it's just the synergy and that comedic timing between Jim Carrey and Jeff Daniels. I think they were just, like, even though everyone seemed to be so resistant of getting Jeff Daniels in this role, like, he was made to play Harry Dunn. Like, they just bounce off each other so well. And it's just a joyride from front to back. Like, I love those two in every scene together, even when they're sort of standing on their own. Obviously, Jim Carrey's a bloody tour de force comedically, but Jeff Daniels does brilliantly in some of his solo scenes. And I think it's just that timing. It's lightning in a bottle.
Yeah, 100% lightning in a bottle. I think overall as well, the overarching story of the film.
Yeah, that's something I kind of skipped over. Like, it's a movie with an actual plot. Mm. There's a hopeless romance, there's a friendship, mistaken identity. It's a road trip movie. There's love triangle. You know, they're returning lost property. It's got everything.
Yeah, it's got all these different little tropes and storylines that all crisscross all throughout it. The stuff with Seabass is like a little revenge plot sort of thing almost.
yeah, that's right.
And callback jokes galore throughout the entire film.
They accidentally kill someone too. I can't believe we didn't mention that in most iconic scenes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, squeezing the mustard and the sauce into their mouths to cool down the hot peppers always gets me like absolutely laughing out loud.
Pills are good. Yeah. And then they rat poison him. And then, they're like on the run for murder.
Yeah.
Like,
they seem to just like pay their bill and go, essentially.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So while we're still talking about what holds up the best, I'm sick and tired of having to eke my way through life. That dramatic scene kind of at the start of the movie that sets up everything to come, that is so important to this movie working for me. You know, I'm sick and tired of being a nobody. I'm sick and tired of having nobody. Like, that is really the first time I think we, as fans of Jim Carrey's comedy, saw a glimpse of what he was capable of dramatically. And that really is the heart of the film. Without that scene, you probably don't have any empathy for these guys who are kind of, they screw each other over and they are very juvenile and immature. But that scene kind of gives you a bit of sympathy towards them and wanting to see them succeed. And I think it's just really a linchpin, because I mentioned the film which shall not be mentioned, the sequel. It doesn't have a scene like that, and it doesn't have the heart that this movie has because of it, and it suffers so much.
Yeah, that sequel just flat out sucks.
I haven't seen it because I heard so many bad things. I'm like, I don't want it to ruin the feeling of the original at all, so I will not. I just refuse to watch it.
I mean, it did. I thought it had some decent jokes, and they're playing the same characters. It's these same actors that we're praising right now playing those characters. So I feel like it really was a missed opportunity to land. And my belief is that it's because it didn't have a scene like that that showed you that these people aren't just idiots.
Yeah.
They're people. They're lovable idiots. Like that scene and them hugging and Harry saying, you know, let it all out. Okay, that's enough. Like,
that just
sets up the rest of it for me. And I missed that in the sequel. So that's all we're going to say about Dumb and Dumber 2.
Did you ever watch the prequel where they had them as young when they first met? It is also
it's
not very
bad.
It's
a dumpster fire of a film.
And the short-lived cartoon was also kind of crappy.
I remember watching that, and even though I was a big fan, I was like, I don't need to like get the TV guide out and circle this. Mm. Like, I'm not going to go out of my way to see this again. So what holds up the worst?
I had a really hard time sort of brainstorming this and putting ideas down. Like, and as it stands right now, like on my notes, I've still got a question mark because maybe I just adore this movie too much, but like everything, like the capsule that this movie exists in, carries itself well into present day, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing that's unrelatable to anybody. Like, obviously, there's no reliance on technology in this film, but like outside of that, it's relatable themes. Like, you know, following your heart, feeling down and out. Yes, being a little bit dumb, having a joke with your mates, just randomly jumping in the car and going on adventures. Like, I think there's a sort of themes and inspirations and touchstones that are in everybody's life throughout, you know, the 90s, the early noughties, and now to present day.
Yeah, I was talking to my brother Dan about this, and it was really hard to think of something that doesn't hold up, because they weren't concerned with being, as Dan mentioned, culturally relevant. Like, they were never trying to be cool. They were never trying to be fashionable or hip. So all those things aren't an issue now. Like, you look at the clothes they're wearing or whatever it might be, and like, yeah, I can still imagine people like these characters who aren't cool or aren't trying to be cool talking like that or looking like that or living like that.
Yeah, I think like the most, and it really does harken back to the 90s side of things as well, even a little bit 80s too with the whole hypercolor stuff. But like that's probably like the one thing from a fashion point that would seem out of place today is like the ski outfit that Harry wears when they're going skiing and things like that.
I don't know. Like people wear some crazy stuff.
They do indeed. They do indeed. But my point being that like, yeah. In terms of being out of place to today, that's probably the most out of place thing. The rest of it all holds up really, really well because there isn't anything besides maybe like a couple of those little fashion choices. There's nothing else there that really wouldn't sit in a film today at all. Like you could write a very similar sort of comedy film today and it'd be comparable.
Yeah, maybe like a dog car's just got like a new vinyl wrap on as opposed to like a
faux fur
dog fur. Yeah, a faux fur wrap. But outside of that, it's real nitpicky. Yeah,
you have to be really nitpicky. I mean,
if you want to get into fashion, like Nicholas, the kind of the villain of the movie, is wearing some bad, super baggy suits.
Oh yeah, those suits are pretty bad. Yeah,
like really baggy pants. That's always a sign of like the 90s. I think
there was the bucket hat was the girl with the skis, the FBI agent. Mm. She was wearing a bucket hat, yeah. I think, in that scene. And smoking at the petrol station as well, which, you know.
that's a good point. I did notice there was a few scenes of people smoking, which stood out to me because it's such a, you know, it's such a choice to do it now, whereas back then it was just the natural thing.
Well, I didn't really notice it so much with, like, everyone else. It was more just that one scene because it's like you're smoking. Mm. At the pump, like she's pulled up next to the pump.
I got yelled at through the PA system the other day for looking at my phone as I was pumping petrol. And I'm like, come on, man. Like,
Mythbusters did that already.
It's going to self-tick over when it gets full. But yeah, this chick was just a bitch.
They always are.
We're talking about fashion, so I should say, like, I think Mary's outfits hold up really well in this film. Like, she still looks really good all the time. Yeah. In my opinion.
I had a little bit of a crush on her in the early 90s from this movie. I think she might have like transitioned into like NYPD Blue or something like that after this. And yeah, I don't know. It was just that ginger fire. I was just like, hello. I didn't know what I was feeling at the time. But looking back at it now, it's like, yeah, a little bit of a crush on her. Lauren Holly.
Before we move on, and we're talking about outfits, you got to give shout out to the outfits that they wear post opening the briefcase and getting all this money. Yeah. They're all classics, like Jim Carrey's kind of cowboy outfit that he wears.
And he walks
in
sort of stiff elbow. Yeah. And yeah, he's got the tassels hanging off and the gloves.
Yeah. And Harry's kind of denim outfit that he's wearing in the diarrhea scene. It's all good. And when they, of course, when they get out of the Lamborghini or the whatever,
the gold wing doors go up.
It's so good.
Oh, yeah.
So this might be a bit easier to answer or harder, depending on your view, but who would be the most offended by this film if it came out in 2019?
Peter.
Well, I didn't have something that holds up badly. I did have a few answers here. You think Peter, is that based on the bird scene or the dog scene?
It's like the opening scenes, he's feeding servo hot dogs, two dogs in the back of a car. The dogs aren't strapped down.
They're sliding around for real.
Mm. Yeah, they are sliding around for real. Petey the parakeet getting decapitated and then onsold to a blind kid. And then obviously an endangered owl getting killed by a wine cork. Like, animals were not treated very kindly in this movie.
Yeah. That's absolutely... I mean, all of those examples, apart from the dog sliding around, you can quite easily see that it's like props and prosthetics or whatever it might be. But it's not sending a good message, I guess, from the Peter perspective. It doesn't take much to put them offside.
Nah.
The vision impaired could be a little touchy about the blind kid getting duped and ripped off. But this is the thing about this movie. It's called Dumb and Dumber, and it's about two idiots. So they can kind of get away with it, with doing these stupid things and it not being held up as... They're not role models. They're not, you know, trying to pass this off or normalize any of what they're doing.
Yeah, I don't think there's any... And I'm just trying to think of the jokes. I don't think there's any jokes that are overtly racist or sexist either.
No. Yeah.
Like, all the jokes are pretty dumb and simple jokes. And I think that's why it works on so many levels and is so clever and easily enjoyed.
There is this idea, I suppose, that the two characters are essentially vying for this woman as somewhat of an object to be won. Like, Lloyd even says, I had that old-fashioned feeling where I'd do anything to bone her. And it's completely... over-sexualized, romanticized view of what she's going to do for him. Yeah. Like, she's going to plug us into the social pipeline. And they're both kind of fighting for her without any knowledge that she's actually interested in them. That's something that... It's a stupid comedy, so it's pretty silly to look too much into it. But I can see people getting upset about it these days.
Yeah.
Yeah, just like objectifying the lead female actress. Simpler times.
Yeah.
Simpler times, the 90s.
Shooting the husband in his fantasy when things don't work out is a kind of another little indication that, you know, maybe she's an object that he feels some kind of ownership over.
Yeah. 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 Mary Samsonite.
Mary Samsonite.
I was way off. That joke was lost on me for so long as a kid because I didn't know Samsonite was a suitcase and luggage brand.
Yeah, I think it took till the internet era when I could actually look up that joke.
I think there's actually a lot of jokes that were probably lost on us as a kid because I was watching, like, I don't know if I picked up on it when I was younger, but watching it back, I was like, oh, wow, they say pussy a lot in this film as well. Like, I didn't even, it never clicked with me before. I was like, oh, they've said that quite a bit.
For the most part, though, the humor is fairly accessible. Yeah, like, you guys watched it as kids.
It's easily digestible.
Yeah, and there's not a reliance on swearing to like be funny or sexual jokes, even though there's a few innuendos in there. It's not the like super bad or like that type of gross out humor, even what we've probably seen from, you know, your Seth Rogen movies and that kind of thing. So I like that it's kind of a PG movie, one that you can think like, oh, I'm going to sit my kids down one day and watch this together and we're going to have a good laugh. And I don't have to like answer any curly questions halfway through.
No, I think, yeah, you're right. It's just easily digestible.
Mm. It's fairly wholesome.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's going to be plenty of people who would not like the bikini girl scene right at the end of the film either these days, but...
The best.
Shit, that's a good scene as far as I was concerned.
Yeah.
I think I put that scene on rewind and replayed it a few times as a kid.
Not surprised. So does Dumb and Dumber pass the internet relevancy test? Does it live on through memes and GIFs?
I think so.
I think so.
Like, there's so many quotable lines that just the three of us alone just know straight off the off the top of our head, you know? Like, there's lines that I still use to this day, and I use that most annoying sound in the world for many, many, many years after watching this movie. And... yeah, I think it's still extremely relevant. Some of the iconic scenes, some of the iconic quotes.
Yeah,
I think it stacks up.
Yeah,
yeah. There's a few that get used on the internet and social media quite a bit. Like, you're telling me there's a chance. That's something that people will throw out there.
That's probably the biggest one, isn't it?
Yeah. And then there's
the I like it a lot as well.
Yeah,
that one's
definitely
a big one.
The clip of Jim Carrey, like, kind of throwing up, but not throwing up, like, trying to...
Yeah, when he sees region. Harry from behind the bushes.
Yeah, you see that get used quite a bit. And even just, like, the title Dumb and Dumber, that's been kind of taken... It gets used a lot in the media, in headlines or, like, captions with... You might have, like, Donald Trump and he's, like, you know, his equivalent in the UK at the moment and like... Or George Bush and John Howard, like, whatever it was, people would, like, tend to throw that out there or they'd Photoshop the faces on Harry and Lloyd.
Yeah.
Would smartphones and social media ruin the plot of this movie?
It would certainly make it a lot shorter, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Like, they could just Google
Mary
whatever.
Samsonite.
Yeah, and it would pop up. You'd probably see a few dozen news articles about her husband being held hostage. But I guess they kind of kept it under wraps now, I think about
it. Maybe
it
wouldn't
get
kept under wraps these days.
Yeah, like live leak and everything else. It'd be all over the internet pretty quickly. So I think that, and at the same time, what you alluded to at the start about how they drove around all day looking for a job, they could just jump onto even Blake Craigslist, get something cash in hand, have some jobs and maybe have no desire to go to Aspen, just hang out, pay the bills so the gas man doesn't get them.
Yeah, well, the scene with the gas man and the payphone, that wouldn't happen at all.
That was great.
I actually really enjoyed that scene.
Get off the phone. I think that the most obvious thing is that Lloyd would have just gone back to his employer and said, can you please give me the mobile number of my last customer and I'm going to call her or look her up on LinkedIn or Facebook or whatever it is and say, oh, I've got your bag. And that's kind of the end of it. So,
yeah, she's like, oh, yeah, no worries. Just leave it at XYZ. Yeah. The end.
But that's I guess the challenge, like making a modern movie without those things. It's I guess we live in times where we have to incorporate social media into our stories and our plots, and it opens up other opportunities. So I think that it wouldn't necessarily ruin the movie. It just changes it.
Yeah.
So speaking of that, do you think you could actually make the movie in 2019? Like we've talked about how it holds up, the humor's still accessible. What would be the 2019 version?
Like sadly, just knowing how Hollywood is, it would probably be some Adam Sandler, Kevin Hart Netflix special and be an absolute dumpster fire.
Yeah.
But trying to recast this and change some of the plot points to make it relevant and believable in this day and age, it's kind of tough. Like
as we alluded to,
the social media, the getting the boss to get the to get the number for Mary. Maybe you could change it up and I don't know, maybe he just wants to do a good deed and surprise her with the package or something. So he travels across country because he still loves Sick. So you could still weave that modern day romance into it, but I don't know who you'd get to play these characters. Like I thought about it, and I can't think of two guys that would fit these roles and do it justice.
I think Andy Samberg you could throw in there maybe.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm thinking off the top of my head, but yeah, it's definitely harder. I mean, and like a guy like Jeff Daniels is he completely came out of left field, so maybe there's a dramatic actor out there that
Idris Elba.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Benny?
I don't know if I'd really want a remake. I don't think you should, and I don't think there's a way you could do it this year. I think it sits perfectly in its little 90s bubble, and
that's it. They essentially tried to remake it with the sequel, and it just didn't work. Yeah,
it didn't work. It didn't translate properly. Like I said, I haven't seen the sequel, so I can't really comment too much. But from they did essentially try to remake it using the same cast as well. So if it wasn't going to work for a sequel, it sure as hell isn't going to work for a reboot.
But in a world where the movie never happened, do you think that it would come out today and be successful? Because I think it would.
I think if the Farrelly brothers wrote another movie of a similar vein, which they have done several other films since.
Yeah, I could see them doing well, or even Seth Rogen, Evan Goldberg, that sort of combination.
James Franco, that
super bad tone,
yeah.
Like with this, but maybe water it down ever so slightly. I think that could certainly work.
It's just hard to picture though, because it's almost impossible to separate it from Jeff Daniels and Jim Carrey, because they are Harry and Lloyd, and it's just so much of it that works is because of them. So as much as it's easy to think, like I can see a world where Seth Rogen or Jonah Hill or whoever is in this movie instead, it's hard. It's a difficult thing to come up with.
Yeah, it's so much of the movie you'd have to change to the suit. I think it'll lose some of its appeal from especially the whole road trip arc of the film.
The road trip in itself is something that feels like a kind of pre-2000s thing.
When I think you couldn't get any stupider, you went and completely redeemed yourself.
And I think like air travel is so cheap now that you'd just get a flight across the country too.
Yeah.
Like, true. I don't know what flights were back in the mid-90s, but I'm assuming it would be similar, like flying around America for, you know, we've both been over there. It's not too expensive to get, internal flights.
How about that airport security though?
Oh yeah. When he's like, sir, you can't go in there. He's like, it's okay. I'm a limo driver.
Straight off the freaking bridge.
It's definitely like a pre 9/11 thing. Cause he doesn't go through any like X-ray machines.
No security checkpoints. And then we've all been through them. So, you know.
Yeah. It's just like parks his car outside, jumps out, and then he's straight on to the tarmac. Yeah. The Steve Buscemi Spark Plug Award. We got some nominees here. I got Cam Neely, who plays Seabass. Harland Williams, he's the state trooper. You might remember him from Half-Baked. He was the hitchhiker in There's Something About Mary. And this was his first film. Victoria Rowell, she plays Beth, the FBI agent. There's not a lot of good or substantial supporting roles. I think it's hard to go past Seabass for me.
Yeah, Seabass was fantastic.
Yeah.
Just that little mini arc that they have there with the beating in the toilet and then the full circle, and they obviously take a lot of liberties with his tab at the diner.
Yeah, that's great.
He actually comes, like, spoilers, Benny, but he comes back as and plays Seabass again in the sequel.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so he cameos in the sequel. But yeah, the supporting cast is pretty, like, they're nowhere near as memorable as the two leads, and they haven't really done much since, so...
Yeah, I think I'm thinking like Half Baked for Harlan Williams, and that's really about it.
Yeah,
The guy that plays the barman at the hotel where Jim Carrey's waiting, he's been in a few roles. One that comes to mind is where he's the sort of the transgender hostess in Shallow Hal.
Okay, another Farrelly brothers.
Yeah, he was in Me, Myself, and Irene as well.
Yeah. Yeah, they keep it's one of those original sort of comedic cliques that you're seeing now.
And I mean, Harlan Williams is really good as that state trooper. Like, he really hams it up, like, sucking back on Grandpa's old cough medicine, and like his reaction to drinking
visceral
is like when he's so sort of like good, but
yeah, his mouth is sort of like cracking. He's like,
I was gonna give it to Seabass, but I think we can give it to Harlan Williams. I think he's the spark plug. So. Yeah.
Get the hell out of here.
He comes in for 2 seconds and just, he does a good job.
He just steals that entire scene. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Killer boots, man.
Last question. Is this still a good movie? And I think we all tend to agree that it is.
Yeah.
Slam dunk, yes. Slam dunk.
100%.
Game over. 100%. Buzzer beater. One of the best comedies that I've ever seen in my lifetime.
Would you go as far to say that they don't make movies like this anymore?
Yes.
Yeah,
I think that it's hard to get a movie, like we said before, like that kind of like PG, you know, 13, whatever it is, film that isn't completely full of like penis jokes and like drug references or sex scenes or whatever it is. It's just kind of, you know, there's some innuendos in there, as I mentioned before, but it's for the most part pretty wholesome fun.
Yeah, yeah, that's a perfect way to summarize it, I think. Like, we won't see a comedy like this again, I don't think, or it'd be extremely rare to see something try and, as you said, land that wholesome feel to it from front to back and make it relatable for kids, for teens, for adults. And, you know, now we're sort of not quite early adults, but, you know, becoming middle-aged and whatever else, and it's still hilarious. It's still great.
And that's kind of something that's going to come up a bit in these 90s movies, I think, is like your kind of Robin Williams, Adam Sandler. The style of humor, I guess, at the time was like, let's make something that's fun for the whole family. And that's something that maybe isn't so much a concern now. There's definitely a really big market for kids movies that, like, it's more of your Pixar. That's kind of their area of making family movies, and like Lego movie, stuff like that. So it's less like, let's give $7 million to this comedian to make a movie for the family.
God, I love this movie.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, like, I'm trying to think of recent movies that are sort of in that same sort of vein where the one that comes to mind is Hot Rod a little bit.
Yeah, that's kind of feels like a 90s movie, though. It has
a
even
very
like,
90s film vibe to it, but even though it came out in, what, late 2000s?
I reckon it is even, like, 12 years old at least by this point, too.
But, like, it's got that same sort of 90s vibe and everything like that. It's exactly.
And it wasn't a big hit either, that's the thing.
No, but it wasn't, compared to what this was. This one was just a massive hit. And again, it's just due to the standout year Jim Carrey had. That name alone just, it drew big.
It did. We did have some questions come in about the movie from Twitter, but we've pretty much answered them all already, so I won't go into them again. But thank you and shout out to DJ Payne and Matt Tilby for sending those in. This is the time to shout out our Patreon producers. We won't be doing this every week, but I thought we did it in episode one. This show exists because of these guys and the other patrons out there chipping in their hard-earned dosh to make it happen as a stretch goal. So I'll give them another round of shout-outs and maybe periodically through future episodes too. So thank you very much to Aaron Lukasak, Andrew Natoli, Anthony Flarida, Chris Nelson, Colin Sparling, Dan Peck, Dan Vumbacher, Howard Smith, Jared Howard, Josh Enor, Liam Hart, Logan Wilkinson, Matthew Perkins, T-Dag, Nathan Tilly Laurie, Pete's, and Screamus. Light applause.
Thank you all very much. You are saints who deserve big cuddles, big kisses, and big beers.
Mm.
Yeah. Thanks for making it all possible.
Absolutely. And it's been so much fun. Like, we've recorded, this is going to air the second, but we've recorded 3 of these now, and I'm having so much fun doing it. So thanks to you guys for being part of it. Thank you to the listeners out there for getting into it and giving us your feedback and and seemingly enjoying it too. If you are enjoying it, I hope that you can take some time to leave an iTunes review. Those are helping us get out there a little bit more, getting up the algorithm. I think that iTunes is kind of reworking what they're doing at the moment, so there's a chance that we have a possibility to work our way up those charts. That'd be really cool. That'd be really great to see if you can help us out with that. You'll be able to catch us next week with, or next episode with Clerks. I'm going to be rewatching that with the Bitstorm boys. And that's, we've already recorded that actually, and it went really well. So
my favorite part is Berserker.
We definitely talked about that.
Berserker!
If you want to have your say, you can let us know what you think on Twitter. Brendan is at Brendan8bit. Benny is at TheSpawny13. I'm at Johnny himself. Thank you for joining us. This has been Comedy Rewind. And as always, dear listeners, be kind.
We've landed on the moon!